Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, October 15th. This is the 39th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an amazing Italian cheese producer who works with some of the best restaurants in New York City and beyond, and I will introduce him in a moment. But first, as I do on every show, I will start with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to appreciate la dolce vita, the sweet life, as the Italians do. They keep it simple, a little mangia, a little bevi. Not only do they eat and drink well, enjoying simply fresh local ingredients in a beautiful setting, but I love how they speak with passion. What's better than being greeted with a ciao bella or toasting buon appetito? The Italians are simply feel-good people, and we all deserve to feel good. So the next time you're a little stressed, take a siesta or have a glass of vino, and remember the Italian way. La vita è bella. Life is beautiful. That's my tip today. I'm excited about my guest. It is Bob Marcelli, the co-founder of Marcelli Formaggi, an organic artisan farmstead cheese producer from Abruzzo, Italy, which supplies products for some of the best chefs and restaurants. A 1990 James Beard Foundation Rising Star chef, Bob previously studied with James Beard and worked under legendary American chef Larry Forgione at American Place. Fast forward to today, Bob is a quote-unquote recovering chef who, along with his son Andrew, formed Marcelli Formaggi to bring the products of their family in Italy to America. So welcome, Bob.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. And I mentioned this on a previous show, how I met you, but it was, so people who don't know, I was solo dining at Marta, and we were both sitting at the chef's counter, which I think is the best seat in the house.
It's the best.
And struck up a conversation. I realized you had a connection with the chef. And what do you know? You supplied his cheese. So there we go.
Happily.
Yes.
Yes.
So let's start with your background and when you became a chef and cooking and then the transition you made as the recovering chef.
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about going back to the beginning. And for me, it was a very practical realization that I wanted to cook. And that was my father's family are from this little village in Abruzzo. And my mother's family were sharecrop farmers in rural Virginia. My grandparents lived with us. And my grandmother did most of the cooking, kind of being typical Italian woman. She really would let my mother help clean up, but not really cook. And it was one day, I was thinking about that this morning. I picture the moment. And my grandmother had this great cast iron skillet, and she was making meatballs, and it was this kind of a Sunday tradition. And my brother and I would take turns distracting her, and whoever would distract her would take a meatball.
Uh-huh.
She knew it, but it was okay. And at that moment, I was savoring how great this was. I went, you know, if I want to continue to eat like this for the rest of my life, I better figure out kind of what's going on. And so that was really my my cooking epiphany.
That's a cool story. Now, did you go to culinary school?
No, I didn't. I had really always worked in restaurants, even starting when I was about 10 years old, in a fish shack on the ocean where we grew up. And then I've just always kind of gravitated towards cooking. When I was married, I worked at the Parker House in Boston for a while.
Okay.
And it turns out that my great-grandfather was a chef there at the turn of the century. So it was a nice little bit of history for me. And I'd been in restaurants for probably, 20 years. And around 1981, I started to think, what would I be doing if I'd gone to culinary school? And I went, well, I'm not sure. And I said, well, maybe what I should do is maybe study with somebody and see if that's the direction that I want to go in. So we were living in Portland, Maine at the time. And I got a hold of a New York City Yellow Pages. And I thought about, who would you study with? And it's like, well, James Beard is really the most well-known person. I looked in the Yellow Pages. I found his phone number, dialed the number. He answered the phone.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
and he said, yes, this is Mr. Beard. And I went and I introduced myself and told him, what I was kind of interested in. He said, well, Bob, I have some classes coming up, and I think, we should come down and we can talk. And so when I met him and explained what I wanted to do, he was really funny. And he said, Bob, well, why would you want to go to culinary school? I said, well, to learn techniques mm-hmm. and things like that. And he said, oh, Bob, he said, what you should do is find somebody really good to study under, and you get paid at the same time. So, long story short, through Jim, I met Larry Forgione at a party that Jim had given. And it was towards the end of the night, and my wife, who was probably 6 months pregnant, I walked up to Larry. I said, hi, my name is Bob Marcelli, and I'd like to come and work with you. And he said, okay.
And that's it.
And that's it.
Well, I love that you call him Jim. I love the whole story. I mean, I have to... do you know they're doing a documentary on
I heard
James
about
Beard?
That, yes.
Well, my guests coming up are the two women who
really?
Are doing it. And if they haven't talked to you, I'm going to connect you with them. Because they need to. Because I'm sure you have a lot of great, great content.
I used to go down and visit him just about every weekend.
Wow.
From Maine. And he was just, he was the most gracious person, and you would try to say, thank you, mm-hmm. You're really, for taking this time. And he just, turned it back, and he said, no, thank you.
Wow, incredible. Okay, so then you were working for Larry Forgione.
Yes.
And then you went to, you opened your own restaurant.
Yes, in Virginia. Okay. In Virginia. And again, that was where my mother's family was from, so I had, history there. I grew up in the ocean in Massachusetts, and then in the summer we would go and spend about a month or so on the farm. And it was just such a, wonderful experience, the smell of, the animals and the pigs and the hay, and it was, mm-hmm. Something I always remembered. And so I thought that would be a good place to open a restaurant because, you've got the Chesapeake Bay, and you've got an incredible, culinary history in Virginia. So that's where we did it. And it was only a little, maybe 70-seat restaurant.
Yeah, but to get the James Beard Foundation Rising Star Chef Award, I mean, that's a very prestigious award.
Yes,
as we all know.
And I kind of joke about that. And in that same year, I think there were maybe 11 or 12 people that won that in the country. It's a little bit different format. And there was a guy named Keller and Bayless and Hammersley and I think they're all still cooking.
Yeah, they are.
So it was good company.
Right. So that's a good transition. They're all still cooking, but you're not. You're doing cheese now. So
yes.
How did you make that transition?
We made, if you will, a family pilgrimage to this little village, which is called Anversa degli Abruzzi.
Okay.
Population 350. We're related to half of the people in the village.
Oh, wow.
Because both my grandfather and my grandmother were from there. I had no idea that that my family were cheesemakers here, because we really didn't have a lot of contact. And the day that we went there, there were 13 of us, so we immediately increased the population of the village exponentially. And I met my cousin Nunzio, and he said, "You know, we have an agriturismo. We have some sheep, and we make some cheese." And I went, "Well, that's really interesting, because you know I've been in food all of my life." And we tasted the cheese, and I looked at him and I said, "Nunzio, you don't make cheese. You make cheese." I had never ever had anything like it in my life, because it was so real. And again, my background enabled me to really get kind of what I was tasting. My father, who passed away about a year or so after that, wanted to do something with the family there. And nobody really knew what that meant, you know, do something with the family.
Right.
Like, you know, put a bench in the village or, you know, I don't know. And it hit me. It's like people would to really appreciate this, you know, real, authentic product. And so when he passed away, he left me a little bit of money. And I said, "Well, I know what I need to do." So.
Wow. So when was this? What year are we?
That was like 2006, 2007.
Okay. So then how did you go about bringing the cheese to the U.S. and getting clients?
The Abruzzeses are very slow and methodical, so it took a lot of time to convince my cousin that this would be a viable thing to do. And I started to bring samples home, you know, in the days before when you could, you know, really put stuff in your suitcase and it wasn't an issue. And then because of who, you know, I knew, and actually Larry was one of the first people that tasted it, and he went, "This is amazing." And we'd met Bert Wolf.
Oh, okay. I remember that name.
Yes. And I had Bert taste it, and he said, "This is really, really good stuff." So I got some great encouragement. And then we just decided to, let's just do it. So we did, and because I knew people, it was easy to get into, you know, to see somebody. Like Mark Ladner was amazingly accessible and immediately loved the product. And Mark is, you know, Mark's been, and Mark Forgione was really our first customer, because Larry said to Mark, "Mark, you have to taste this cheese."
Yeah, and they are all great chefs.
Yes.
So good connections. Awesome. Okay, we're going to take a little break here, come back, talk a little more about cheese and with Bob. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry and Heritage Radio Network.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And Point of Origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Bob Marcelli of Marcelli Formaggi. We are talking about cheese. So, Bob, I wanted to find out more about the region of Italy where your cheese is coming from. Like, what makes it special, and why the products coming from there are even better than we have elsewhere?
Abruzzo is known as the green heart of Europe. It has more national parks than any other region of Italy, of Europe, not just Italy. It's very pristine. It's very mountainous. And historically, because it has been so inaccessible because of the mountains, there is very little industry there. The bad news about that is that there was very little work, which is why my grandfather left when he was 18. He said, we need to eat.
Mm-hmm.
The good news about that is that because there has been no real industry there, it's remained almost untouched. So it's just a pure, pure place. And the population, I think there's 7 people per square mile, so it's really not greatly inhabited. There aren't really any big cities to speak of. I think the largest city was L'Aquila, which was destroyed in the earthquake. So when you have animals and you make products that come from the land, it's very clean. And
Oh no, go ahead. No, I saw on your website that you have this Sopravvisana sheep. So tell me about these sheep.
Well, what my cousin wrote his thesis in the 70s about what kind of a viable business could be rurally based, preserving tradition, and still have an impact on the local economy. And he came up with the idea of a farm, because it encompasses, you know, the historical nature of the Abruzzo was a pastoral setting. So he started this farm in a small way, and then over the course of time, it's grown. And so they have a cooperative, and everybody in the cooperative, what they do is they specialize in rare breeds, many of whom are almost extinct. This breed of sheep, Sopravvisano, at one time there were 3 million sheep of this breed in Abruzzo, and today there's only a couple hundred thousand. The unique thing about them is that they produce 1/5 of the milk of a normal breed of sheep. So if you took 5 glasses of sheep, of milk, from a normal sheep, you'd only get 1 from this breed. And I say to chefs, it's really like working with a reduction, because the milk is so incredibly rich that it still takes the same, the normal amount of milk to make cheese, but it's so rich and concentrated, it's mind-boggling. And that's really the thing that when chefs tasted it for the first time, they were amazed, because you said, well, I have Pecorino, and, it's New York. Everybody would yawn and go, oh, really, Italian Pecorino? I've never had it before. And they taste it, and you just watch their face kind of go, are you kidding me?
So it's these sheep. They're like magical sheep.
It's the breed, and it's what they eat. It's the old, you are where you eat. They've in the Gran Sasso, where the sheep graze, they've identified over 120 wild herbs and flowers. And so you take that breed of sheep and its metabolism and what it eats, and you combine those two things, and just the flavor of the milk is really, really remarkable. So that's kind of the characteristic of products from Abruzzo. Very clean, natural.
So what types of cheeses do you have? There's more than one type of Pecorino, right?
Yes. Interestingly, I think we have about 6 different kinds of Pecorino.
Okay.
It all comes from the same milk, but they are completely different just because of how they make it, or how it's aged, how it's kept in the caves. It's amazing.
I don't think this show we have enough time for. I need like cheese 101 yes. plus. But
okay, tune in next week.
Tune in next week. So what? But tell the other cheeses you have. What you have ricotta?
Yes, the ricotta is a byproduct of the cheese making process.
Okay.
And when we think of ricotta, we think of the stuff in the tub in the mm-hmm. deli case. This is aged for about 2 months, and then it's cold smoked over juniper. So the milk is really sweet, and there's that little slight hint of smoke. It's not overpowering at all. He's got goats, so they do an aged goat cheese, which is really, really remarkable. And then some of the other members in the cooperative do cows. Nobody duplicates what the other one does. So one is... Caciocavallo Pezzata Rossa, which was the original breed that they made Parmesan from, so it's got this nice, nutty, kind of sweet flavor. And another one is Caciocavallo Podolico. And the Podolico cow, I think there are only 20,000 of them in Italy, and it's just a mind-boggling cheese that's produced by one of the few women cheesemakers in Italy.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking I'm having cheese for dinner. That's it.
I recommend that strongly, yes.
I bet you do.
I think that's a good call.
I bet you do. And you also, you had some other products also. I mean, do you bring, there's an olive oil, or are these parts of what you do as well?
Yes. One of the things that we wanted to do was, and this goes back to what my father's wishes, was to really kind of try to have a little bit of an impact. So the members of his cooperative, they produce honey, olive oil, jams, jellies, and pasta. The interesting thing about the honey is that the bees that pollinate the flowers that the sheep eat produce the honey. So it's a wonderful synergy of products. It's when you compare that honey...
Mm-hmm.
With the cheese, it's just
they pair.
It's incredible. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what are the most popular products that chefs are purchasing from you?
Well, we have a couple of different schools, and that is I've got chefs that only use our cheese. I have chefs that only use our pasta, and I have a few that use the cheese and the honey. And maybe one customer in Jersey that uses everything. So it's kind of funny.
So is it just personal preference or what the chef is, what works on their menu?
I think it's what works. Del Posto and La Condaverde have used our honey in their pastry department since, you know, for 6 or 7 years now. It's, people say this is the best Italian honey they've ever had. It's really good. And then some people swear by the pasta. Nobody's mm-hmm. had pasta like this before.
It all sounds so good. I'm getting very hungry. Okay, now let me ask the question I had from last week. I had on Daniel Gross and Dana Marie McKernan of NYC Hospitality Consulting Group. And they asked, what are you doing that's different to attract New York City restaurants to order your products, noting that there are other cheese farms in the area as well, of Abruzzo and Umbria. You sort of, we've been talking about this, but is there anything more to add of why, you know, what are you doing to attract the restaurants besides being fabulous you?
Well, as a recovering chef.
Yes.
I'm not a salesperson. And actually, we tend to only sell to people that we like. And there are really a lot of people to like in New York City.
I like
that's,
it.
That's the good news. But because it's a personal connection, this is the cheese of my family, so I can talk about it, I think, a lot more to the point than just if I was a salesperson.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
And it's authentic, and that's what people are looking for.
Yeah, certainly. No, you, and from that you were in the industry, you've been a chef, you have the connections, and I love that, you know, working with people you like. I think that was one of my tips one of these weeks. Okay, great. So we're going to take one more break here, and we're going to come back. I'm going to do my speed round game, and we're going to talk some industry news. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Bob Marcelli of Marcelli Formaggi. And it is time for my speed round game. So, Bob, what this is I am just going to name two things, and you pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, fabulous. Eat in or eat out?
In.
Wine, beer, or cocktail?
Beer.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
Tasting menu.
Small plates or large plates?
Small.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Soft or hard cheese?
Soft.
Working with Larry Forgione or working with Mark Forgione?
I didn't work with Mark, so that would be Larry.
Well, you're sort of working with Mark now.
Yes, okay.
It's a different level.
Larry.
We'll give it to Larry.
Larry.
Two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
A cheese plate of dessert.
Very cool. Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Abruzzo?
Abruzzo.
Yeah, give it to Abruzzo. Great. You were excellent in this game. Very quick. Okay, so industry news this week. First article I wanted to bring up, it was in the New York Times, and it's food news, and it's also food news around my neighborhood because I live by Columbus Circle. And it was talking about how in the depths of the Columbus Circle by the subway, they're building a retail hub underground. And they have... It's going to be a food court, sort of, and it's being run by Susan Vine, who overhauled Grand Central Food Court. And I think it's cool. I mean, I've walked down this tunnel, basically between 58th and 57th, many times. It's a great escape when it's very cold. And they're planning to put in lots of food purveyors, coffees, cupcakes, maybe some cheese. I was wondering what your take on this was, and if, like, would you sell your cheese underground by a subway station?
Well, cheese is aged in a cave.
Aha. So I take that as a yes.
I think it would be a good thing, yes. Yes. And it sounds like a fantastic idea. I mean, we've, you know, there's only so much space above ground, and there's lots of people below ground in the subway system.
Yeah. I think it's very cool. I mean, they were saying how the retail the rent will be a little cheaper too,
right,
for these vendors to go in. So, I mean, it's right where I live, so I wouldn't mind having that there and having to be able to get a cup of coffee or whatever they're selling. The plans are to open sometime next year.
Mm. No, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, cool. I was excited to see that. Another article in Eater National, why fine dining chefs are getting into the chain game. And this was talking about how, well, the fast casual restaurant industry has grown tremendously. Well, last year it grew 11% in 2013, and it's $173 billion sales is what they're saying it did last year. And it's noting these chefs like, well, there's Josh Joshua Skeens from Saison, who's partnering with Adam Fleischman, who has Umami Burger, and they're doing a place called Fat Noodle. It said Jose Andres was thinking of going casual. Chris Jackal just opened a place called Uma Tamakaria, which is a like fast casual sushi place. Mm. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's a perfect extension of the kitchen. Chefs don't eat fine dining every day, and when you know you're done at the end of the day, and you want to, you know, you want to have something good to eat, and you know, to have your choices be limited to fast food, I think is not great. And who better to figure out ways to do things quickly and well than you know, fine dining chefs?
Yeah, I agree. And I can't help but think of Danny Meyer, who's run away with this category. I mean, you know, talk about someone who was just doing fine dining or you know, just regular dining of New York and elsewhere. And now he's got the fast casual Shake Shack, which is just has exploded.
And I think the other part of that is that it's very difficult to make you know, money in fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to do expansion, the money has to come from someplace. And so I think the fast casual segment, you know, you can do great numbers, and you can use that money to fund more fine dining restaurants. And the point is, it's more work, which is really good for...
More work for people.
Yes.
Right.
Not yes.
More work for them.
Well,
yeah.
Yes, it is, but
yeah,
that's the
both.
Nature of the beast.
Yeah. No, I think it's a trend that I don't think is going to end anytime soon. I think more and more high profile chefs are going to keep going in that direction. So we'll stay tuned to see what else comes
about.
Okay. The last article I wanted to bring up was how Esquire magazine just named the best new restaurants in America. And this column was always written by, John Mariani. And Josh Ozersky just took it over. And there wasn't a really big announcement that Josh is their new restaurant editor. I knew he was writing for Esquire, but John has done this list forever, or 30 years forever.
That's a long time.
And so it was an interesting list. They had a party last night at the Cecil in Harlem, and that is the restaurant he named the best new restaurant of the year. I haven't been there yet. Have you been there?
No.
It's interesting. I mean, it's gotten some other good press. I'd like to go. It's actually next to this jazz club. It sounds like a really fun night out. You know, you go have dinner, listen to some jazz. But I will have to go check that out. He also named Paul Key, whose restaurant is in Austin, the chef of the year.
Mm-hmm.
He named Take Root in Brooklyn on the list of best new restaurants. And I just recently went there because my previous guest, Ben Leventhal, told me it was fantastic and you had to go. So that was on the list, and it is a fantastic restaurant. Mm. It's tiny. I don't know, did you see this list? Do you know any of these names?
Well, I think what struck me is that traditionally these top, you know, 10, 20 lists are usually very, very high profile places that usually are expensive and not necessarily, you know, user friendly in the sense of you could go there a lot, and so what? Consequently, I think what happens is that chefs that are doing really wonderful things at lower price points don't really get the recognition that you know, 4-star, 3-star places mm-hmm. get. So it's kind of refreshing, I think, to flip the table a little bit and to give recognition to those, you know, other kinds of places. I think it's a good, it's a good direction.
Yeah, I think it is nice. And I've noticed, I mean, Bon Appetit this year, with their list, they picked a lot of small, eclectic sort of places as well, not necessarily the most well-known or the most expensive.
Right. So. I fell into that category. Our restaurant, what was it named? One of America's top six trend-setting seafood restaurants, which floored me.
That's awesome. Hey, why not? Take it.
Exactly.
But I think in New York sometimes there's so many restaurants that, you know, it's hard to be noticed in a sense. And I think if you're a different part of the country doing something amazing, you can, you know, if as long as someone like Kate Crater, who's on my show too, comes out and finds you,
right.
You get on the list.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's just a matter of being found.
Yes. And we were very happy that we were.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Okay. We're going to take one more break. We're going to come back. I'm going to do my solo dining experience. Stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
All the music you've been hearing today is from Iggy Dean from her EP, Heart and Lung. This is All in the Industry on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
My name's Edward Lee, and I'm the chef at 610 Magnolia in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer, and this is now time for my solo dining experience of the week. Okay, so this week I went to Mimi Chang's Dumplings, and here's the rundown. The location, 2nd Avenue between 11th and 12th Street in the East Village. The concept, authentic and delicious Taiwanese dumplings, homemade recipes, handmade daily, always fresh. The chef and owners, the Chang sisters, Marianne and Hannah, and their mom, Mimi. Why did I go? Because I heard they were offering the most authentic and delicious dumplings. My experience? Well, I stopped in mid-afternoon for a snack, and I was greeted by Marianne, who was genuinely warm and friendly and very helpful with my order. What did I get? Well, from her advice, I got 6 dumplings that she told me I could get 2 different types. So I had the Mighty Veggie and the Reinvented Classic, which came with pork. I also had their house drink, which was a half freshly made apple cider and half iced tea. My take? Super fresh and flavorful. Loved both dumplings, and the drink was a perfect combo. The scene, it's a small place, casual setting, counter service with a communal table and stool seats, and has a nice open storefront window. I would say it's perfect for anyone looking for a quick bite That's all I got there. Quick tasty bite. There we go. Okay. Interesting tidbit. Their mom's real name is Shirley. Her nickname is Mimi. Personal fun fact. I took an Instagram photo of the Mighty Veggie Dumpling, and my photo won a contest they did, so I now have a free pass to SoulCycle. So thanks, Mimi's. I look forward to spinning off my dumplings. The cost, $12 total. Would I go back? Absolutely. Their website is mimichangs.com. Okay, so it's now time for the final question. So, you have something prepared. So, Bob.
No, I don't.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, you have about 15 seconds to think. My next guest is Matthew Riznick. He is the executive chef of catering of Great Performances, which is an exclusive caterer in New York City that caters at most some of New York City's most prestigious cultural institutions. So, Bob, what shall I ask Matthew?
Well, we know that today it's very easy to get really high quality ingredients because of people like me. The real question is, how do you get, keep, train really good culinary talent?
So how does he do that? He has a lot of staff. It's a big company.
You have to have a lot of staff.
Yeah, well, awesome. I will ask him. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And thank you for coming out here today. I'm glad I met you.
Me too. It was a great pizza.
Yeah, it was. It was. Marta has chosen well working with you in all these great restaurants. I mean, your cheese, I'm telling you, and having cheese for dinner. So, thank you.
My pleasure. We're very fortunate to have the customers that we do.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Okay, I've been talking to Bob Marcelli of Marcelli Formaggi. Their website is marcelliformaggi.com. If you miss this live broadcast, you can always find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We're also on Stitcher, and we're on iTunes. Thanks always to my engineer, Jack, and to everyone out there listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you'll tune in again next week when I'm back with All in the Industry at 4 o'clock on Wednesday. Till then, have a great week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.